Hi, I'm Grant Wall, and welcome to the Planet Football Podcast, where I go in depth with the most intriguing people in the world of soccer. On today's show, Danny Carbassian tells his story of being at Arsenal, where he remains the only American ever to score for the Gunners' first team, including the surreal story of going on trial as a Virginia high schooler and being thrown into a first-team training session with Arsenal's famed Invincibles.
It was a remarkably special time at the club as well. Guys like Henri, Bergkamp, Perez, Vieira, all these guys were there, and it was kind of just, they're already jogging around the pitch, so just to join in with them and have a, you know, hour and a half session playing with arguably some of the biggest stars in the world.
All that and my thoughts on soccer coming up.
Take one.
Here we go with my three thoughts on soccer. First up, I love European soccer. I love the intensity, I love the passion, I love the way the sport saturates the culture all over the continent. I'm fired up for the Champions League knockout rounds to start this week too, but I'm not thrilled about something important. Here we are in the middle of February and teams are running away with the titles in the top European leagues. Whether it's Chelsea, Bayern Munich, or Juventus, the league leaders are miles beyond the competition at this point. Even the race in Spain isn't as close as it looks in the table. Real Madrid has a 1-point lead on Barcelona, but with two games in hand, that's more like a 7-point lead for Real Madrid, with the away game at Barcelona already played. I love European soccer, but it's frustrating when the league titles are decided so early, and this season it's happening earlier even than normal. One U.S. television executive I know thinks the European League should have a one-game final between the first and second-place teams in the league to decide the champion. And while that idea would be sacrilegious to many, I think it's an idea worth considering.
Take two.
Next up, now more than ever, if you're into watching Yanks abroad, the country to look at is Germany. Not a single American played in the English Premier League this past weekend, which has sadly been a common occurrence this season. Germany was a different story, however. No fewer than 8 Americans played in the Bundesliga over the weekend, with 7 of them starting. Christian Pulisic, Fabian Johnson, John Brooks, Bobby Wood, Timmy Chandler, Alfredo Morales, Aaron Johansson, Terence Boyd. Boyd even scored his first goal for Darmstadt in an upset of Pulisic's Borussia Dortmund, and followed that with his trademark goal celebration where he puts his Cyclops eye tattoo on his arm up to his face and runs around like a maniac. It wasn't long ago that England was the country of choice for American players in Europe. Now, it's Germany, and that's not a bad thing.
Take three.
Finally, I think you'll enjoy this week's interview with Danny Carbassian, the Arsenal Yankee. Even though Carbassian had to retire at age 22 due to injuries, his story is fascinating on multiple levels. That's true in playing terms, where he didn't throw away his shot, getting into an Adidas High School All-Star camp off the wait list, winning the Golden Boot that week, and earning a trial and contract with Arsenal's Invincibles. His story is also fascinating in terms of his post-playing career. After retiring at 22, Carbassian could have been bitter. But he kept going in soccer, becoming an Arsenal scout, writing a book, and starting a digital company that's just announced a round of funding this week. Here's my interview with Danny Carbassian. Our guest today is the only American who has ever scored for Arsenal's first team. Danny Carbassian played for Arsenal, Ipswich Town, and Burnley before injuries curtailed his playing career. But he's still active in the soccer world as a scout with Arsenal, who discovered Gedeon Zalalem and Joel Campbell, and as a founder of Fury 90, a mobile fantasy manager game, and the company Soccer Without Limits. Danny wrote an excellent book, The Arsenal Yankee, which you can get on Kindle and online at thearsenalyankee.com. Danny, thanks for joining me. I'm doing well. Appreciate you taking the time to join me. You're in London, I'm here in New York, but thanks to the internet, we can actually have a conversation here. First off, just wanted to say I reread your book again this week ahead of our interview. It's a really good read. I recommend it for everyone listening here. It's a nice window, in my opinion, into a pretty rare story still of a young American being discovered by a top Premier League club, a top European club, and going over and getting the opportunity to play with that club, and an amazing era of that club as well. That was the Invincibles era at Arsenal. And just to start here, Is it possible if you could tell the amazing story of how Arsenal discovering you came about in 2003?
Absolutely. So I grew up in Roanoke, Virginia, and kind of went through the whole ODP system, playing travel soccer and whatnot. And going into my, I suppose going into my senior year when I was a junior, I was actually waitlisted for the Adidas ESP camp, which was conveniently in Wilmington, North Carolina that year, which was, you know, in the States, I suppose, only a 7 or 8 hour drive, I think, from Roanoke, which was close enough. But So I got waitlisted for that, and several days actually before the camp started, I got a phone call from Adidas while I was in my backyard kind of pounding a ball against my wall, frustrated that I wasn't going to be going to that camp. And a representative from the camp was on the phone and said somebody had dropped out at the last minute and that if I could make it down to Wilmington, then I would have a spot at the camp. So I rang my parents and asked them if they'd be willing to drive me, you know, several hours down the coast. They happily obliged, and I kind of, you know, I went there with the hopes of getting a college, you know, a college scholarship. I was hoping that your UVAs or Dukes and UNCs would, you know, I'd finally get a chance to show them in a really competitive setting that that I'd provide value at their schools and in their programs. And I went. I just happened to be kind of by, you know, by fate, I was put into a team where the coaches were former Arsenal players. So Bob McNabb and Paul Mariner were the coaches there. And during the week, they actually they were asking me kind of like funny questions, like, you know, could you ever see yourself playing overseas if the opportunity came about? Would you take it? You know, being American, being so far away from home, being so set on kind of wanting to go to school and all that. And then they kept asking if I was positive that my mom was born in Italy, and I had no idea. I had no idea why they wanted to know where my mom was born. I found it kind of weird. But I soon realized that the Italian passport or any European passport in general was vital for playing here in England. So I ended up actually winning Golden Boot at the camp. And 2 days later, I got a phone call from Steve Rowley, who's the chief scout at Arsenal, asking me actually if I'd ever heard of Arsenal Football Club, which was kind of, about 2 weeks later, I believe I was on a flight headed to London, for a 2 week trial, and, it went well enough. I let them know that I wanted to at least finish high school, just so I could get that under my belt. School was always, you know, quite important for me. I graduated valedictorian of my class, so I at least wanted to, I at least wanted to have my high school, you know, under my belt, wrapped up. And then I went on 2 week trial, finished high school, and then ended up moving to London and started my career there.
And during this 2 week trial, you go to Arsenal. You're a high school senior. How soon was it that they put you on the field in a training session with the first team?
As I said, a 2 week trial. I spent most of the time with the reserves, and the reserves were guys. They've changed structure slightly here now with under 23s and kind of moved things around. But the reserves at the time were guys that were too old to be playing in the youth team, so in the 18s, and I would have been too old had I signed. So I went straight in with the young pros, basically. Or if they were really, really good in the youth team and they were progressing at an excellent rate, then they'd be thrown into the reserves as well as guys that were kind of on the cusp of the first team or in the first team and weren't particularly getting many minutes. So I spent about 95% of the time with them. And then I believe 2 days before my trial ended, I went out as normal with the reserves. And when I got out to the pitch, the reserve team manager, Eddie Nedvicki, who's been basically Mark Hughes's number two everywhere. Mark's gone. He was our reserve team manager at the time. As we got out there to warm up, he said, "Danny, you're with the first team today." And it was very abrupt and very just, you know, basically go over there, make the little jog across the pitches, and then take a right turn and into the first team area at the training ground. It actually happened to be media day that day, and I didn't know any of this, and the press is allowed into the training ground on very few occasions here in England. And when I turned the corner, there was about 500 cameramen and journalists on the sideline, and they see me turn the corner. I've never seen, you know, probably my face or anything, and all the cameras turned over. It was during the summer as well, so, you know, they're all looking for the latest signing, a new story or anything, and I could just hear all the cameras just firing off. So it was very interesting. And as you mentioned, it was a remarkably special time at the club as well. Guys, like, Henri, Bergkamp, Perez, Vieira, all these guys were there, and it was kind of just, they're already jogging around the pitch, so just join in with them and have a, hour and a half session playing with arguably some of the biggest stars in the world.
I got to admit, as confident as I would want to be in that situation, I would not want to just faint seeing those guys out there.
Yeah, I would describe it as being, I would have been content enough just watching the session, to be completely honest. I mean, just because I'd seen in the Premier League, some of them had played in the World Cup that summer. Because I was, when I went on my trial, it was 2002. That first trial was 2002. So, the guys that advanced quite far in the World Cup had maybe had 1 or 2 weeks left in their break, but for the most part, a majority of the team was back. And it was interesting, but you quickly realize that you're also trying to impress, the best manager in the world who's standing right there. The chief scout, the scout that brought me over, is standing on, standing on the line. They're watching as well, So, and I've learned, over the past kind of decade being a scout, that when a scout does bring a player over, it's a pretty nerve-wracking experience too, because you put your name on the line in that regard. So, I'm sure Steve at that point was like, okay, Danny's been with us for 2 weeks now. Now he's going to get thrown into the deep end. Let's see how he does. So, it was a very interesting and exciting time.
Well, and they offered you a contract. You eventually decided to accept that contract offer and turn down college scholarship offers in the U.S. You go over there and you become the only American still ever to score for Arsenal's first team eventually. Tell me the story of how that happened.
Yeah, so at the time, breaking into the first team, and still, it's a very, very difficult process. I think people underestimate just how difficult it is going from being. It's remarkably difficult going from the youth team and getting an actual professional contract, and then going from kind of a reserve or an under 23 now, and breaking into the first team and actually making your debut, and then getting into the first team dressing room is, I don't even, 1,000x more difficult than going from the youth team to the reserves, just because of how big business it is now, how you open up the net to the entire world of talent as well at that level. So at the time, the focus on the Premier League and the Champions League, which it still is very, very high, but the Carling Cup was a tournament that the youth would get a chance if you were doing very, very well. Or I say the youth, the younger players or the players that were in the first team that were not playing regularly would get a chance to actually play. During the build up to that, to the day that I made my debut, actually Arsenal had lost. They'd been 49 unbeaten, and then we lost at Manchester United at Old Trafford that weekend, actually, and we ended up drawing Man City in the cup at Man City. So it was a very interesting time at the club, because I'd only seen Arsenal either win or draw for the better part of a year and a half. So seeing the kind of the mood of the training ground was very, very different. But I got to train with the first team in the several days leading up to the game. And then the actual day of the game, I wasn't in the starting 11, and generally we train with the starting 11 the day before, so you have an idea if you're actually going to be starting, whereas the bench is kind of not a toss-up, but you're not 100% sure if you're going to be on the bench. So I came into training, they told everybody to wear their tracksuits that day, and if you weren't picked to travel, then you would just have to train as normal. And I came into the training ground. They put a list up on the wall, just like they do in high school sports when you're trying out. And it's not very difficult to see when my name is on a list because of the length of it. And I saw it there on the list, and it was a wonderful feeling. That was around 9 o'clock in the morning. Kickoff was at 7:45 that night. So the guys that did get selected, we took a bus to a local airport here, got on a kind of a chartered flight, and went up to Manchester, checked into a hotel, spent the entire day basically sleeping in the hotel, and then drove to the game that night. As I mentioned, I was a sub. I got to come on in the 82nd minute. We were winning 1-0 actually at that point. Robin Van Persie, who some of you may know, was actually making his Arsenal debut that night. He actually scored his first Arsenal goal, and whenever I tell the story, I say he went on to score several more than I did. But so we were winning 1-0. The game was quite open at that time too, and there was a lot of guys making their debut for us that night. Cesc Fabregas was actually playing. He wasn't making his debut because he'd made quite a big impact already at the club, despite being, I think, 17 at that time. Wow. But Manuel Almunia was making his debut. Johan Giroud was making his debut. Philip Senderos. A lot of guys were younger guys, like Matthew Flamini was in there as well. In the 82nd minute, I came on. I was just pretty much ecstatic to be wearing an Arsenal shirt that had my name on it that I hadn't actually purchased, you know, at Eurosport. And it was a great, I got to be on the pitch for, I think, 10 minutes. In the 92nd minute, we broke down the right-hand side. A ball got pulled back to Cesc, and Cesc is still, you know, one of the most intelligent, most aware, smartest midfielders in the world. And I pulled Danny Mills out of position and then ran behind him. Cesc played a perfect ball, and I took a touch, and I was a striker. I was playing left midfield, but I was, you know, I'm a striker at heart. I had played as a striker my whole life. And despite being, you know, 1-0 up, and actually I look at replays now and Van Persie was completely open. And I likely should have passed to him, but he'd already scored. And, you know, I didn't want to be the first American to have an assist at Arsenal. That didn't have the same ring to it. So I shot and I shot and scored. And then they actually ended up, Robbie Fowler actually ended up scoring immediately after the kickoff. So we ended up winning 2-1, which was a pretty nice little, I guess, surprise for me and a great way to start my Arsenal career, I suppose.
I mean, a score in your debut with the first team for Arsenal is pretty incredible, among other things. You trained and played with the famed Invincibles. They didn't lose a game in the 2003-04 Premier League season. Which players on that Arsenal team, there's so many huge names, but which ones stood out to you the most as a teammate and why?
I would say, I mean, every single one of those guys was pretty unique in their own way, which is amazing because as a team, they were just incredible and unstoppable. But you know, as individuals, they were all so different, but also alike as well. I mean, they all had this mentality, this winner's mentality, that to go 38 games without losing, especially as you kind of get to the business end of the season where you're a target for absolutely everybody, and every single game in the Premier League is a tough one, you know. And going to Highbury and seeing us sometimes go down a goal and then fighting back, and still winning or drawing was remarkable. In terms of individuals, I was a huge several players I was massive fans of. Robert Perez was probably my favorite player. He technically, I think all of them were technically fantastic, but Robert had just this kind of this elegance about him that was very very hard to beat. He was a very, very classy footballer, and it always looked very, very effortless for him whenever he was dribbling, whenever he was doing things that nobody would think a footballer would be able to do. And then he scored loads of goals as a wide guy as well. And he'd come in and he had a very distinct way of shooting as well. He never particularly used his laces. It was always the inside of his foot. He always side footed absolutely everything. And he could generate quite a bit of power with it, but he scored some pretty amazing goals. Thierry Henry, I think, was, I still look at him. I still look up to him. You know, as a kid, I watched him play in the 98 World Cup, and I think he was at the time maybe 21 or 22 as well. And the day that I actually went there on my trial, he was one of the first players that walked in. And my dad and I were sitting kind of in the reception of the club, and he walked in and he came over and shook my hand and said, "Hi, I'm Thierry." You know, it's one of those. Like, yeah, I know. But it was just, it was amazing. He had always at the club, I mean, still now too, even when he was in New York, you know, you don't have to be a football genius to know that he's got quite a bit of swagger about him, and he knows, you know, he knew he was the best striker in the world. And I think it showed week in, week out in the Premier League, in the way that he handled himself and the way he scored goals, especially when they needed him as well, you know. So I think those two guys were my favorite at the time.
We do see Patrick Vieira quite a bit here in New York. He's the coach of NYCFC right now. What was your sense of him?
I like Patrick. He's a great guy. I mean, I spoke to him quite a bit because we always seem to get injured at the same time. So when I, I don't know why, but whenever I was doing my, you know, I'm not talking big injuries, but more so just, you know, muscle stuff, and where I'd be 2 weeks out, and we'd always be kind of on, you know, bikes together. We'd be with the fitness coach together, and I enjoyed it, and I started kind of understanding what exactly it meant to be a team captain and a leader, especially at that, you know, at that level. I was the captain for my travel team back home, but I don't think I ever particularly knew what it meant to be a leader. I'd like to think that I kind of led my team by scoring lots of goals and showing them that this is how we should play. But at that level, everybody's very good. In that team, everybody's very, very good. And Patrick was an absolute fighter. And you'd see it, especially in the Man United, kind of at that time, Man United Arsenal, that rivalry was incredible. And his just his ruthlessness, his ability to get in there and slow things down if they needed slowing down, speed them up when they needed speeding up. And you always knew that guy had your back. And he was very, very talented and a massive leader as well. So I think it's great to see him. It's to me, it pains me seeing him kind of associated, you know, with the whole city set up now. But it's cool to still see him involved in the game for sure.
I know you've still got a lot of friends who are teammates from your Arsenal days. Who do you still stay in touch with?
I still speak with Philippe Senderos quite a bit, actually. He probably ended up being my between him and Moritz Voltz, who went on to have a great career at Fulham, and he played in Germany in the championship as well. Those two guys were really, really good friends of mine. I still speak quite a bit to Cesc Fabregas as well. Cesc, Philippe, and I we all signed the same year at Arsenal, and they actually lived in Digges, which is basically where you go live with a family, or, you know, a woman or a guy that takes after you or looks after you. Sorry. And they didn't drive. And because, you know, us Americans drive when we're like 15, I moved over there, had a car. And I think initially we became friends because they wanted to use me for rides home. But eventually we did become friends, and they started inviting me into the house to hang out. It was funny. The foreigners would always hang out because we were kind of all in the same boat in terms of being away from home. You know, linguistically, it was a bit different for me, although I didn't understand half the English people anyway. But for you know, Cesc didn't particularly speak much English when he was here, and I spoke my high school Spanish, and that's how we kind of connected.
Nice.
Philip Sendero speaks about seven languages, so that wasn't an issue. But yeah, we became good friends off the pitch, I think, and I think that's why we're still, you know, really good friends to this day.
I do think I remember we had coffee one morning in Barcelona when I was over there for a story, and you over there for work, and I interviewed Cesc on that trip. He was still with Barcelona. I think you were hanging out with him later that night. Is it still weird at all for you that Cesc plays for Chelsea now?
Yeah, it is. It's still, it is strange. I think I see him. I was at his, you know, I was at his debut when he broke into the first team. He was, I think he's 2 years younger than I am, or a year younger than I am, and he was the one that was training with the first team every single day. And I think he was 16, I believe, when he made his debut and absolutely ran the show in a cup game. So to me, he's always kind of been, you know, Arsenal, and seeing, having him leave, it was tough to go to Barcelona, but it was something you kind of understood, and you know, you say, okay, fair enough. You know, if you're from a place that arguably has the best team in the world, best team ever, and that's just in your backyard, and you're going home, and you've already been there, then, you can kind of see it. But, seeing him go to Chelsea has been certainly interesting.
Arsene Wenger wrote the foreword for your book. He obviously cares about you as a person. What did you learn about Wenger interacting with him behind the scenes that the public may not see as much of?
I would say it's amazing. I think in this world, especially at this level, there's a lot of people that only know the sport, they only know their team, they only know the league, and that's it. And there's a lot of people that's just the only thing you can speak to them about. Despite, you know, being one of the best managers in the world for ages, and being in the conversation with, one of the best managers of all time, he's a guy that is far more than just football, and he knows he can have a conversation to you about politics. He can have a conversation to you about history, and he knows so much about his team and his players, and I think it speaks volumes of kind of the teams that he builds as well. He knows the players, and it's our job as well as scouts to kind of get a full bio of the kind of guy that you're bringing into the club, because you don't want to disrupt the situation at the club, obviously, with the team and whatnot. But I remember I actually, during that weekend of my debut, I was going down the elevator from my room to go eat lunch with the team, and the boss was in there with me, and he said, "Hey, Denny, how's it going?" I said, "I'm well." He said, "Are you excited about tonight?" And I was like, "Yeah, it's pretty exciting." He said, "How are Italian lessons going?" And I mean, I was because my mom's Italian. I speak to her. I was taking Italian lessons just to kind of keep fresh through the club, but I had no idea that he would have known that. And he just asked, how are the Italian lessons going? And then he asked, your dad, your last name, your dad's Iranian, right? And it was just kind of a surreal conversation about stuff that had nothing to do with the game in hand or your football in general that he knew, which I quite like, because he was a guy that knows his players, knows his team, but also knows the game really well.
I don't know if you've seen it, but I would highly recommend this to listeners. There was an interview that Wenger did with, I think it was L'Equipe Sport and Style magazine about a year and a half ago, that is the smartest manager interview I have ever read in my life. And somebody online translated it into English. It's astonishing. I basically would not ever use that word to describe many interviews, but this one is. I'll put a link to it my Twitter at some point here. But it's, when you say that he's a smart guy, it definitely comes through in that interview as well. I mean, also his longevity in the Arsenal job is incredible. How has he been able to do that in such a high turnover job in the modern game?
I think it also goes back to, he knows more than just football. Being a guy that went and took a job in Japan initially, and then kind of came into England as an unknown, and brought a very kind of different brand of management and style to the English game, and kind of I don't want to say disrupted the game, but definitely brought a new way of creating a culture within a club, and transforming the way they played. I think that means a lot. He's certainly spent a lot of time on finding very, very good young players and turning them into from unknowns into absolute world beaters as well. And that goes a very long way. I can't speak on behalf of all the clubs now. I know football's become a very, very global game, but for all the time that I've been associated with the club, Arsenal have had a pretty amazing scouting network kind of scattered throughout the entire world, with their fingers on the pulse everywhere. So I think that's cool, because he also understands that it is a global game, and he's not afraid to bring in guys that nobody's heard of and turn them into players that everybody's heard of. And I think that's helped kind of him stick around for quite a while.
Does it pain you at all, considering the amazing legacy that Wenger has, that some Arsenal fans are highly critical of him sometimes, including sometimes now?
Yeah, I mean, of course it does. I think at the end of the day, everybody's ultra competitive and wants to win, and we all have the same goal. The manager, the team, the fans, everybody wants to win. Everybody wants to win the Premier League. Everybody wants to win the Champions League. So I understand why it'd be strange if all of our fans were just completely complacent and said, this is completely fine. It is frustrating as well, because he has done such a wonderful job at the club and brought us through some pretty amazing times in terms of, initially when he came in 1996, and then leaving Highbury, leaving all that kind of tradition and history behind, and going to the Emirates and having to deal with a different, more so limited budget in terms of player recruitment and getting new guys in. Still finishing in the top four, still making Champions League during all of this time, and we've seen in recent years, that some of the biggest clubs in the world with the biggest budgets in the world aren't in the Champions League if they have a bad year, you know, and he's been able to navigate those seas and consistently be there. So it is frustrating. I've been lucky enough and kind of been humbled enough to know him since, you know, 2002 in terms of my first interaction, and just seeing how, you know, how far kind of everything's come and how different kind of the club is now from when I went to Highbury the very first time on my tour when I was on trial to now, you know, going to the Emirates for the first time. I remember it felt a bit like a foreign land to me. So I can't imagine what it was like for fans the first time they left Highbury, had been going there for years and then had to go to the Emirates. And it's definitely changed now. But yeah, I think it's hard to see it happen just because of how much he's done for the club, for sure.
You had to retire from playing at age 22 due to injuries. You write about this in your book. When you've put so much into soccer and have to call it a career that early, what was that like for you mentally to have to deal with?
Yeah, it was very hard. I mean, I don't want to say it's still very hard, but soccer to me was an outlet, you know, mentally, physically, emotionally. Whenever anything bad happened, I picked up a ball and went out and played soccer. Whenever I was feeling good or good things happened, I'd pick up a ball and go do the same thing. At 22, when I was at Burnley, the doctor, I'd had, I believe, three surgeries up to that point on my right knee, and we'd just gone on a preseason run, and my knee had swollen up pretty massively for 2 weeks, and we went to see a doctor, got a scan, and doctor said there's structurally actually nothing wrong with the knee, ligament wise and whatnot, but he said, but it looks as if your knee is knackered, and those were his English words, about as English as you can get. And he said, if I were you, I'd hang up your boots if you want to walk when you're 30. And, you know, as I said, when he said the first bit, when he said everything looks structurally fine, I didn't really care what he had to say for the second piece, because I said, oh, I'm fine, I'll just wait a little bit. But when he dropped kind of the hammer on that second piece of that statement, it was very tough. And I, as you said, soccer to me was my, you know, my life. I'd always wanted to be a pro. The opportunity had finally come to become a pro. I didn't know how it would happen when I was growing up in the States, but when it was presented to me, I said, wow, I never would have thought this would happen, but here's my opportunity to become a pro. I had left Arsenal and I'd gone to Burnley. It was very, very different, but I was still determined to kind of carve a career out for myself in England. Even at Ipswich, when I went to Ipswich Town, I'd played, six games in the league when I was there, six or eight games there. And, it was a level that I was comfortable at, and I was willing to, you know, I was more than willing to put the work in to get myself back into the Premier League, and I was excited to get myself back in the Premier League. So, having this happen was a huge kind of fork in the road for me, and it didn't take long for me to realize, look, I can sit here and dwell and then become a guy that had the opportunity and then this happened and now Lord knows what he's doing, or just kind of put it behind me and really focus on what I needed to do next in my life.
I want to get into what you ended up doing next in your life, what you're doing now, but I also just wanted to ask, as someone who's written a book, it's not a small thing. And I remember running into you, this may have been the first time we actually ran into each other, was at a Starbucks in DC several years ago. And I think did you introduce yourself to me or was it the other way around?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think you tweeted, I checked your Twitter to see if you were indeed in DC and you said you were. So I was like,
well, I'm glad you did that. But I remember, I think that conversation, you might have mentioned you were writing a book. What went into the decision to write that book and how hard was it?
Yeah, I've always really, really enjoyed writing. And I think traveling all the time, when I began scouting, I believe I was 23 when I began scouting. And, when you're on a plane going everywhere three times a week, flying between 150,000, 200,000 miles a year, you have quite a bit of time to think and not look at Twitter or Instagram or anything then. Now you can, but because of Wi-Fi, but then you couldn't. And I began kind of just writing about initially about my travels, and then And then I kind of started just writing little snippets of my things I just remembered when I was in England, just for myself. And I'd find myself kind of, you know, laughing or not getting emotional, but getting a bit nostalgic about my time in England, thinking, oh, I'm glad I'm writing this because, you know, in 5 years' time, there's no chance I'm going to remember this. I ended up having a really, really big knee surgery, the one that not that it ended my career because my career had already been done, but they cut my bone, realigned my joint, put 4 screws in it, and a cadaver meniscus as well. So that effectively ended kind of any sort of proper sports that I would be doing. Yeah. And during that time, I had the surgery in Chicago, and my uncle asked me to write about the night that I scored the goal. So I wrote that, and he came back from work and he said, this is really cool. He said, can you tell me what happened next? And then I said, yeah, sure. So I wrote that the next day. And then he said, can you write about what happened prior to that? And then I started realizing I kind of had a little bit of cohesion to this story that I was putting together. And I just continued adding on it as I was traveling. And I ended up telling Steve Rowley, the chief scout. I said, Steve, I've kind of written this book about my time in the U.S. and I've been speaking to people, thinking about kind of what to do with it. And he knows Tom Watt really well. And Tom was a ghostwriter for David Beckham. And he said, mm-hmm. Danny, why don't you let Tom read it and just give you his advice? And I met with Tom in London the next time I was there. He read it and he like loved it. I think he loved it because it was such a contrast to David Beckham's story, you know, and as a storyteller himself, he said, you know, this story needs to be out there. This is so cool. This is such a different kind of outlook on the football world and a different reality. So yeah, I started pursuing it. I ended up getting in touch with an agent, and it ended up getting actually about 4 years after finishing writing it. It ended up getting published this past year. So it was a pretty big milestone. As you said, it wasn't easy, and it is quite a bit of work. But it was I think it was certainly well worth it for myself. So
I think it's awesome, and I think it's cool for Americans as well to read that. You know, whether you're a kid, whether you're older, you can go places as an American in world soccer, and that's, people have done that, but the stories need to get out there.
Absolutely. And that was that was kind of one of the biggest things too in writing the book was a lot of people only, especially at that time, and now because of NBC's, you know, media deal and everything, there's so much more visibility in the league here now. There's amazing content that's produced on a weekly basis in terms of your favorite teams and everything. But then it was, you would basically just watch the game at the weekend for 90 minutes, and then immediately after, you wouldn't even see press conferences. It would cut to either a baseball, sports center, you know, something it would cut to that had nothing to do with what you just watched, basically. So there was so much more than just that. And I had no idea about that growing up because I had watched the same thing on television and then wait 7 days and then watch it again on television, you know, or wait for that one night where they showed all the highlights from, you know, a 30-minute highlight show of all the goals around the world, which was wonderful, but it wasn't enough. And I wanted to kind of shed light on, you know, what happens after the game. Where do the players, do they just go home and wait for the next game, or what's actually going on, and what's like a normal week like? What's a normal day like? And I wanted to shed light on that sort of stuff.
You mentioned Steve Rowley, the Arsenal head scout who signed you in the first place when you were playing. He then offered you a job as the club's North America scout. Was that an easy decision to accept that offer?
No, again, and actually going to Arsenal in the first place was I don't want to say it was difficult. It was a dream that I wanted to do, but I think a lot of Americans, they think to themselves, okay, I'm going to go to high school, graduate high school, I'm going to go to college, and then my life will start after that. I think guidance counselors in high school ingrain that in your head. So, that's kind of the flow you're meant to go. So leaving my high school in Virginia and graduating as the valedictorian, having my guidance counselors tell me good luck on that soccer camp instead of going to college was quite interesting. But there I was, kind of come back, and I'd driven up to Virginia Tech. As I said, I grew up in Roanoke, and Tech's only, you know, 30 minutes away, and I'd driven up to Tech several times to get applications and kind of all that good stuff. And I was pretty adamant and set on going back to school, you know, around, you know, trying at least to get back in. And when Steve called and said, would you like to do this? I thought to myself, maybe this could be super therapeutic as well in terms of having a proper segue out of my playing days and still remaining in the game at a high level with an amazing club. So I ultimately decided that would be the right choice.
What I'm sort of fascinated in what scouts do and what separates good scouts from mediocre scouts, because there's certain scouts out there that have made a reputation. But what are those good scouts seeing on a repeated basis that others are not?
I think, I think there's several things. I've learned, certainly living here, that it's a very different animal kind of scouting, let's say right here where the team is and where the league that they're playing is in, as opposed to and now I'm really only doing kind of first team football. So I'll go to Premier League games and championship games and I'm watching kind of the cream of the crop. Whereas in the US it was more, or in CONCACAF in general, it was far more foreign scouts have to know their whole territory inside out. And it's what 12-year-olds are doing well at the moment, to monitor, so you can at least have a heads up on them. So when they do turn 15, 16, it's not a surprise. What guys are doing well in the under 17, let's say national team, what guys are doing well, as I said, throughout all of CONCACAF, are any guys doing well in MLS, doing well enough to actually get seen to have a conversation with, Steve Rowley about, and even in college, like if there's anybody that's actually performing well enough to have a chance. So, it's kind of all this stuff. I think looking at players in CONCACAF and determining whether or not they'd make it in England, I believe, was very, very tough. Watching a player anyway and saying, okay, that guy's going to make it in our team. If he comes in, he'll fit in. He's got the mentality. He's got the ability. He's got the discipline. Like that. It's a very, very hard job, because you're looking at something that's not where it's meant to be and saying, will it fit in there and will it 100% work? And generally, when you're doing that in the Premier League or the Championship, it's going to be a pretty big transfer. Whereas looking at a player, for example, let's say in Southern California, a boy who's spent his whole life in 70-degree weather, living with his family, very comfortable where he is, and then saying, we're going to move you to England where it's, 40 degrees, it rains every single day, you might see the sun sometimes, you'll likely get hailed on later on in the day if you do see the sun, let me throw you here and see how you do. You don't 100% know how it's going to turn out. And you can bring kids on trial and they'll do well. And then you might bring them back later and then they just don't end up settling. It's not uncommon in any of the clubs in the world. It's even not uncommon in the first team. You'll see some pretty high profile, amazing signings come into the Premier League and the guys just don't settle and end up leaving and going back to their home leagues and their home countries, one season later. So I think that's probably the hardest. The hardest part is, you try to cover all your bases in terms of, are they disciplined enough? Tactically, are they intelligent? Technically, will they be able to, do enough? And then ultimately, is their personality going to be strong enough to actually cut it here when the going gets tough, when they're away from home, when, they have 3 weeks where they can't complete a pass? Like, are they actually going to be able to kind of rise above all that and make it? And the players that do make it are the players that are able to do that.
You identify Gedi and Zlalem for Arsenal. He ended up signing with Arsenal. What's the story of you and Gedion?
I get a lot of inbound messages for the next Ronaldo and the next Messi and the next Pele and everything, as you can imagine, especially because of social media these days. And kind of filtering through all these and filtering through sometimes the noise and seeing if something makes sense, actually pursuing it, especially at the time in CONCACAF when, every single place I went to was likely a flight. If I'm getting up and going to watch a player, it would almost 99% of the time have been a flight. With Gedion, he actually was living about a mile and a half away from me, ironically. And I got an email from, I remember Matt Pilkington, who was his coach at the time at Olney, and he said, Danny, I know I don't know you, but Alex Yee, who you do know, is my assistant, and he recommended I reach out to you. I have a player, he's quite good, he's 13, and he has a German passport. And the German passport thing was probably more enticing than the actual, like, I have a player and he's quite good. So I said, okay, well, the hard part is done. I'm not going to go see that he's amazing and then be unable to do anything with him. So I said, okay, cool. I actually said, let me just wait a little bit. And I think I waited several months actually. And then he emailed again and I said, okay, I'll make time and actually come up and watch him train. And I went up, I believe it was like a January, in DC, I went to see him train with his club team, and yeah, he was 13 years old and remarkably intelligent, tactically aware, more so than any American I'd seen at that time. Sure, certainly, and technically, he was just on a different level. There's you know, I was lucky enough to go to Arsenal when I was 17 and see guys like Cesc and see guys like Johan Giroud and guys that came through and played like a bunch of games for Arsenal. And I saw why those guys kind of came through and made it. And seeing Cesc at 16 when he came, I thought to myself, like, how does this kid make everything look so easily? And I kind of had that watching Gideon amongst his peers, and he was playing, you know, up a couple years as well. He had that kind of air about him as well, in terms of, you know, you're in a 5v2 and for 10 minutes Gideon was never in the middle, just because he was more aware than everybody and was never under pressure because of his movement before the ball came, where he would take his first touch, the passes he laid off and everything. So when I saw him initially, I said, this kid's very different from a lot of the kids that I've seen at this level for various reasons. That doesn't necessarily mean he's going to make it. That means, okay, now I'm interested. Let's see what he does at a game, you know, in a week's time or in 2 weeks' time. So I started tracking him, and Matt was very good in terms of not actually letting his parents know that I was even going to games. So I would just go to the games and sit on the sideline and watch. Probably over the course of, I would say, maybe two months, I probably watched him play four or five times. And sadly, his team beat every team like 8-0. So it didn't really do any justice either. So I was like, this isn't really helping my decision making in all of this. And I knew they were actually going to Dallas Cup in April. So I then was introduced to his parents and said, we'd be really interested in bringing your son over. I wanted to make sure that we'd arranged it before he went to Dallas Cup, because when you do, you know, when you go to big tournaments and you do well, you're going to get seen and everything. So, yeah, we ended up bringing him over on trial shortly after Dallas Cup. And, yeah, I think he came over at 14, I believe, the first time, just to train. And he went from training with the under 15s initially, I believe, or under 16s. Then he was starting with the under 18s and continued to do very, very well. And then the last two or three days, he ended up actually training with the reserves as a 14-year-old. And, you know, Arsene Wenger, Steve Rowley, Pat Rice, all these guys are actually sat on the sideline watching Gideon. Because they actually want to see when youngsters come in, and if they're doing well and they're making an impact, then they want to actually see what's happening as well. And they like to have an eye on, you know, what's going on within the youth system. So, yeah, when that happened, it was great, because you see Gideon with boys that have played in the Champions League, that have made their debuts already for the first team. And Gideon was right in the mix of it, in the middle, actually influencing the session and getting the ball and laying it off and doing all the things that I'd seen him do, you know, on that cold kind of January night in D.C., just doing it at a very, you know, at a very high level at this time. So yeah, it was great. He ended up getting, you know, offered the contract. He was too young initially to move over straight away. So once all the legalities were done, he was able to kind of come over here and start fighting for his career.
You mentioned earlier that a scout feels some pressure when somebody that they've brought over performs, plays on a trial in front of Wenger and the other coaches on the coaching staff. Were you there, or what kind of feelings did you have when he first went over there and they took a look at him? And did your nerves compare at all to the nerves you might have had during your playing career?
Yeah, it was pretty nerve-wracking. I mean, it's pretty nerve-wracking. It's easy to say, to sit on a couch and when you look at a player play and say, oh, we should sign this guy. Why haven't we signed this player? Get on Twitter and in 140 characters say, oh, the club is stupid and like we should sign these guys. It's very different when you're standing next to, you know, your bosses and you've successfully brought a player over. And in my 7 years that I was in CONCACAF and full time in CONCACAF, I brought over I believe, 4 players total during that time, just because we're not a club that says, oh, let's just bring them over and give them a shot. If it doesn't work out, then, you know, it doesn't matter. It's a, you bring the player over 100%, you know, 150% sure that the club, that he's good enough to sign for the club, and then it's up to the player to actually do it. So it was pretty nerve wracking. I was there. The scouts come with the players and serve kind of as liaisons during the time to ensure that they're comfortable. You know, at this point, you've probably established a pretty decent relationship with the family. So his dad was over as well, and you're a familiar face, which is, you know, something positive when you're in such a stressful kind of environment in a 2-week, very, very intensive, very, you know, you're fighting for your dream here. So it's nice to have somebody that you recognize from, you know, the other side of the pond there with you. So, but during the session, I was sat right there with Steve and with Arsene and, as I said, Pat Rice, and they were, yeah, they were pretty excited, which was a very good feeling. So it was a very big sigh of relief.
Now, recently, Gedion was sent on loan from Arsenal to Venlo in Holland. What's your sense of his development, where he is?
I think, yeah, so last year he went to Rangers. I think one of the things that Gideon's needed to work on is the physical side of the game. Is, you know, being a midfielder in the Premier League is no easy task. Being in the Premier League is no easy task, but being in the midfield and fighting those midfields is quite difficult. So I think he went to Rangers with the goal of getting more physical and being able to deal with more the adult side of the game. You know, this loan deal, it's all about playing in the first team and getting more minutes. You know, he's at a very interesting point of his career now where at that age, you have to be playing, you know, especially after you've gotten a taste of playing first team. There's nothing like knowing that you're actually playing for 3 points. And it's kind of, I didn't particularly understand the importance of it until I went to Ipswich and then came back to Arsenal. And not that you say, like, I'm too big time to be playing in the reserves, because the moment you do that, then you're in big, big trouble mentally and your career is not going to be going in the path that you want it to. But there is also something to be said where you like to be in an environment that's remarkably competitive, where there are fans who are paying lots of money to come watch you play each week, and you're fighting for points either to stay alive in a league, to get promoted to the next league, and you're actually fighting for a cause. Whereas in the reserves, you were more, not that you weren't playing for the club or the team, you were also kind of, each week it was like you were on showcase, because you're either going to get offered a new contract or you're either playing for, you know, to get a contract elsewhere. So for Gideon right now, it's important to be kind of back in that environment playing. You know, he's and they're in the second division in Holland, and they're, you know, in a great spot. So he's now getting a pretty good experience in terms of, once again, that promotion push as well, and what it means to fight for promotion and ultimately see it through and get to the highest tier of football in that country.
Now, these days, you're not just working as a scout for Arsenal. You also have your own company, Soccer Without Limits. You have a mobile fantasy manager game, Fury 90, that you're involved with. Tell me about it.
Yeah, so several years ago, a good friend of mine, Adam Davis, who I met, I suppose, on the circuit in the U.S., as I'd like to say. he was actually an agent. He's an American. He's an American guy as well. He went to UNC, but he was working for probably the biggest German agency, one of the biggest agencies in the world that's located in Germany. We met on the road and said, you know, we've got some pretty unique networks and connections kind of in this space. I wonder if there's anything for us to kind of do. How can we kind of leverage these networks that we've built and create something quite special for fans, as well as you know, some of these players, as their social following start to get astronomically high and they're becoming kind of brands themselves. So initially we started Swole, which was at first a content site. We actually got into an accelerator in Miami and moved down to Miami and got office space for a bit. We started with this content site, quickly realized that we weren't particularly enjoying it and we weren't providing any sort of unique value prop to anybody with it. We launched just before the 2014 World Cup. We ended up launching up an iOS version of this game that allowed you to play kind of fantasy soccer every single day through simulations. And Lucas Podolski actually ended up playing about 2,000 games. Damiao ended up playing several hundred games during the World Cup. And fans actually quite enjoyed engaging with these, you know, with these influencers. So we took the game down, ended up getting into another accelerator in San Francisco. So now we'd hit the big time. We were moving out to we're moving out to Silicon Valley, ready to you know, attack the tech space properly. And after spending about a year there, we said, you know, we're building a football game for football fans, you know, with football players actually involved in it. What are we doing here? We need to move to London. So we ended up moving to London. We've actually raised money from footballers as well. So Alejandro Bedoya and Maury Sedu from the American side have invested in us. Jerome Boateng, Luis Gustavo, Philippe Senderos, these guys that we've kind of known over the years. And really just it's amazing, these guys specifically, because they're very forward-thinking athletes, and they understand kind of the value of, you know, kind of this longer-term vision of what we're trying to succeed with. So we're looking to get the game actually in soft launch and probably in Holland here in a month, and then launch at the start of the season in August again. So we're pretty ecstatic.
Nice, congratulations.
Thank you.
How much in the terms of hours are you spending each week on this compared to your other stuff?
Yeah, so this is my day to day. I wake up. We have office space here in London. Go to the office, you know, in the morning, and I leave pretty late at night. And at the weekends, I'm doing one game generally a week for Arsenal, and as I mentioned, around London in the Premier League and the Championship. And then I come back, and it's something that you're, I think when you start a company and it becomes real and you have employees and there's a vision, and now specifically we have, you know, we have investors on board and everything, it becomes very real. It's hard to switch off and not think about it. So it's taking up a majority, if not all, of my time.
Makes sense. It's interesting because it sounds like you're plenty busy, but I also have read your book. I've listened to your podcasts. You've had regular appearances on Howler and their very good podcast. You clearly know the game. Do you ever have any interest in doing media at some point, whether it was like you know, TV analysis of Premier League games or something back here in the US?
Yeah, it's definitely been something that's I don't want to say on the back burner on my mind, but I always, when I watch games and I see analysts speaking about the game and I see people breaking down the game at halftime and after the game and whatnot, and specifically now in the U.S. with all these new shows talking about the game, I think it'd definitely be fun. At the moment, I'm completely enamored with what I'm doing, you know, for Arsenal as well as, you know, with Swole on my daily basis. But it definitely could be something in the future. I think not from a point of view where I just want to be on television, but I think I've had a unique perspective on the game and learned from some of the most interesting, kind of well-respected people in the game as well. And it's things that I haven't particularly heard elsewhere, you know, even on television with some of the experts. It's some of these things that I'd love to kind of share with people as well that I've learned over the years.
Well, I think that would be a cool thing. One last question for you here. You talked earlier about one of the first questions you had about Gedion Zelalem was, you know, does he have a European passport? He did, and that was an important thing, not just his skill. We've seen Christian Pulisic be able to get an EU passport and be able to start his career at Dortmund before the age of 18, which is currently the limit for minors transferring between countries. But if you have that EU passport, you can go to Europe. Are you in a position where you wish FIFA would reconsider that rule because so many American kids are prevented from what you had with an Italian passport or Pulisic with a Croatian passport of getting that opportunity in Europe?
Yeah, I think it's a tough one because I've seen kids as well, or I've heard stories and agents have told me, and not specifically kids that I've been involved with, that come with false expectations and then just end up in situations they don't need to be in. And the football world, despite being you know, the beautiful game can have quite a murky side to it as well. And I think it's done in the best interest of protecting certain people from doing certain things with players that might not be ready to come over here, you know, and giving them false promises. So although it is quite limiting and it can be very frustrating, I think there's other options that are very, very good that allow players to come over and develop in countries and kind of work their way through through different ways. And you know, the reverse of that is Christian's good enough, goes to Dortmund, is playing weekly at Dortmund, and you say, how come we can't have that all the time with American players, you know? So that's the reverse of that, and I'm 100% on board with that as well. Like, that's, you know, me having the opportunity to just move here without any issues once I got my Italian passport was wonderful, but I also see the flip side, so it's a bit of a difficult question.
Well, Danny, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk. I've really enjoyed the conversation. He's Danny Carbassian. You can find him on Twitter, Snapchat, and Instagram at @dcarbassian. His book, The Arsenal Yankee, can be bought on Kindle. It's also at thearsenalyankee.com. Thanks for joining the podcast, Danny.
Thanks so much, Grant. I appreciate it, man.
Thanks for listening to the Planet Football Podcast. I'd like to thank Danny Carbassian, as well as everyone at Digital Media and Sports Illustrated who supports this podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, there are other great new and archived episodes you can check out, including my recent interviews with Sunil Gulati, Sean Francis, Moya Dodd, Kate Abdo, Colin Udo, and Rory Smith. Do me a favor, and if you like this podcast, please share it with your friends. Subscribe and review the podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.